if we didn't have money, basically, right, then like animals, for instance, what they do is that they engage in violent behaviors, perhaps. Let's say like if we didn't have money as a tool, and then if there's a conflict, then the way to solve conflict could be we depend on might. We would just fight each other and the stronger could win. But the introduction of money, the same as laws, the human beings find a way to solve conflict and problems without resorting to violence.
Hello and welcome to Bitcoin with Jake. This is a podcast all about people's personal journeys to Bitcoin. I wanted to know more about the people converging on this new form of money. Why do they see value in it? What skills enable their understanding? How is it changing their lives? If you're a founder looking for funding or an investor looking to make investments, then please reach out as I develop my network in the space. Do me a favor and chuck us a 5-star rating on whichever app you're using to listen, or a like if you're watching it somewhere. As insignificant as this may seem, they help a startup project like this hugely. Lastly, if you have any questions at all, please just reach out. The easiest place to find me is on Twitter at Jake E.S. Woodhouse. Now, on to today's episode. Today, I'm speaking with Nozomi Hiyase. Hey, Nozomi, how are you?
Hi, it's good to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining. So
sure.
I always begin the podcast in the same way. So can you rewind and remember where were you and what were you doing when you first came across Bitcoin?
Okay, so I first found out about Bitcoin at the end of 2010, and I was a student studying psychology. And then at the same time, I just began to start to write and start to engage in journalistic activities. And, you know, for me, it's one thing to find Bitcoin, but it's another thing to actually go deeper into the Bitcoin rabbit hole. Yes. And for me, when I first found out Bitcoin at the end of 2010, it was when WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange was thinking about using Bitcoin as a way to circumvent the financial blockade. And at that time, I was really focused on WikiLeaks and was writing about events that surround WikiLeaks, basically kind of like engaged in the journalistic activities. So it really caught my eyes, you know, it's like, what is this money and then what it can do in terms of, you know, its ability to circumvent the censorship and enable freedom. So that kind of first got my interest. But at that time, like when I first found the Bitcoin, I didn't quite realize its significance, of course. It was in 2013, actually, when I became familiar with Andrei Antonopoulos' work, his advocacy for Bitcoin. You know, that's when I kind of like really started to understand the significance of this technology. So that's when I also read the Satoshi's white paper for the first time. And even though I didn't have any computer science background, but I was able to kind of see there's something there, you know, there's something significant. And at the same time, I also read the essay written by Nick Szabo. He's very respected cryptographer and inventor of Big Gold, which was the precursor to Bitcoin. So I came across his essay, Chaining Out the Origins of Money. And so when I read that essay, it just blew my mind. It's basically, I started to recognize that money is funded by the evolutionary impulse. And it's actually a tool that enables collaboration for us to evolve as a species. So that kind of helped me to see money not just like in the economic terms, but like something that concerns the human beings. And then at that time, you know, I was studying psychology, so that kind of sparked my interest more, that I started to see, wow, you know, this invention of computer science, that has huge impact in defining who we are as human beings. And then I was able to see the psychological, spiritual significance, I guess.
What an awesome start, Nozomi. So many things for me to ask you questions about from just that small introduction. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Where I will start is, so you were studying psychology.
Yes.
For someone like myself and probably most of the listeners, what does studying psychology involve and what does it teach you about humans?
Wow, that's an interesting question. People who study psychology, you know, many of us getting into this field, wishing to understand human nature. And then like, you know, everybody else who had that kind of ideal, I guess, you know, I was very much disappointed with psychology, and mainly because psychology that has become a part of natural science to kind of step back a little bit. Psychology actually had roots in philosophy. When it established as a field, as a discipline, it's got divorced from philosophy, and it's established itself as kind of like experimental psychology at first. And then when it moved to the United States, that is when psychology as a field became very predominant and was kind of able to, you know, establish itself as a legitimate field. And then the way that psychology managed to establish itself was making it as a part of natural science. And then for that, you know, obviously, it just has to divorce from mythology, literature, you know, philosophy, you know, those things that are considered not to be science. So in the sense that psychology started to apply the empirical method. And the empirical method is basically based on reductionist approach that relies on five senses, and anything that cannot be touched or seen touched through five senses are eliminated from the research processes. And then it also, by using the empirical method as its epistemological foundation, it denied introspection. So, you know, things like thought, feelings, you know, these are, again, eliminated from research processes, mainly because they cannot be objectively measured. If you say, like, I feel this, you know, how can you say, like, you actually feel this, right? Or, you know, how can you actually say somebody's thought can be objectively measured? So the psychologists who employed the empirical method, they are like behaviorists. They basically eliminated, you know, in my opinion, the essential part of what makes us human, thought, feeling process, and et cetera, et cetera. Wow. So obviously, as a result, the view of humanity that came out of that narrow methodology is incomplete. It doesn't really represent who we are as human beings, in my opinion. And then the another component is that behaviorists used animals. So they essentially didn't see any difference between animals and human beings. So they were using lower animals like rat, pigeons, and then extract the data from that to define what human being is. So there's obviously issues because we are not rat, right? We are not pigeons. I mean, we could, you know what I mean? We have all other more complex things going on. And then also the behaviorists, they firmly believe that they wanted to find a way to control human behavior. So that was one aim, that one of the aims that they were engaged in, that they wanted to somehow control, you know, find a way to control human behavior to better perfect our species. And so I was, yeah, deeply disappointed with that image, this narrowly defined image of what a human being is. And in fact, when I was studying psychology, I was jealous of students who are studying philosophy, you know, because they seem, or literature, because they seem to engage in a deep question of what it means to be human. And that, you know, Shakespeare or poems, poets or art, mythology, so they provide, their work provide richer view of what human beings are. So for me, it was a series of disappointment. And then I felt that psychology has lost its soul, you know? I mean, and if anything, I have to, you know, somehow find a way to bring soul back to psychology, because psychology itself doesn't provide us.
And so this is what I love about these conversations, is at some point, this is going to help you understand Bitcoin in some way that other people don't look at Bitcoin in the same lens. Yes. And so we'll get to that eventually. But so you were studying psychology, and you've explained to me brilliantly some of the challenges you found with it. And so how did you end up in the journalist space as well? And how do those two things kind of combine? And I'm very interested in the very obvious use case of WikiLeaks. So right, he was someone that deep state had a problem with, and they were canceling him, you know, 15 years ago. Bitcoin potentially was a solution to that. So perhaps you could just piece that puzzle together for us. Yeah. Like how that all fits in.
To get into this, you know, I wanted to maybe share a story of my childhood. And I grew up reading C.S. Lewis' masterpiece, The Chronicle of Narnia. I don't know if you are familiar with the children's story.
I never read them, but yes, I know of them. And then the films came out, and I think I maybe watched some of them. But it was a book that I was recommended as a child, and I sadly never read. So, but yes, I know what you
mean. I read it like so many times. It's basically seven chronicles. The first one, The Witch, Lion, and the Wardrobe.
The Wardrobe, yes.
Right. Yeah. And the basis of the story is that there is this mythical land called Narnia. The land of Narnia was taken over by White Witch. And a White Witch, you know, keeps Narnia always in winter. Winter without Christmas, you know? And then, so they are animals, you know, the living creatures in the land of Narnia. And then Aslan, which is the lion, you know, the king of the beast, he gave right to free speech to animals so that the animals in land of Narnia, they could speak, right? But then since White Witch took over the land, the animals became muted and then became silenced. And then also the White Witch turned animals into stones. So there's this like a tyrannical force that you know, the White Witch brings. The children of Adam and Eve, you know, human beings who are living in London, you know, Lucy, Susan, Edmund, and Peter, they found a way, the portal into the land of Narnia. They basically served for Aslan, served for this lion to take back Narnia so that they could free this land, you know, so that was the story. So I grew up with this. And then when I was reading this as a child, it really kind of awakened this kind of morality imagination. Like, you know, it's like there is this something happening, you know, this is battle between good and evil, and I somehow have to be a part of, right? So interesting, as a child, I was expecting like this kind of moral battle that I would become a part of. And then seventh story, the last one is titled The Last Battle, right? So for some reason, I didn't read the last one, okay? So I grew up with this, and then that became like a driving force throughout my life. Like I felt like there is this force of evil, force of oppression, this White Witch, you know, that I have to somehow fight against and try to claim maybe freedom of speech, right? So when I moved to the US, I saw it. I saw somewhat this kind of force of White Witch, that this tyrannical force or oppressive force that I've seen in reading this children's story. And then somehow that kind of led me to engage in social justice movement. Like I became an activist. I worked hard to bring social justice. Yeah, I was inspired in many ways, the old social movements that has happened in the US, you know, civil rights movement, women's right to vote, and the free speech movement, and the anti-war, and the social justice movement, and the series of movement that has happened in the US. So it was when I saw the rise of WikiLeaks on the internet in 2010, you know, when the organization released the Blood of Matter video. That was it. Like, I felt like, wow, you know, I see this Aslan, you know, now the Aslan is back, and that I am now be a part of this moral battle. And we have this WikiLeaks is called Sunshine Press. You know, so it's like bringing sun. But basically what Julian did was using cryptography as a tool to emancipate humanity. And what he wanted to do is that he wanted to empower the weak. You know, he had this slogan, transparency for the powerful, privacy for ordinary people. So he had this creative use of a cryptography, and then believes that the cryptography could be used as a nonviolent weapon for ordinary people to fight back and take back, you know, the rights that belong to us. So that's what Julian did with his creation and his work with WikiLeaks. So I was deeply inspired by that. And in fact, Julian is, I say, one of the individuals that deeply impacted and changed my life. You know, in many ways, my thought, a lot of philosophical ideas and thought were informed by him. So I got involved in the organization that I wanted to, you know, somehow help what they're doing. And for me, I wanted to basically inform the public about what WikiLeaks is, educate people about what this journalistic organization does. And mainly because there was massive propaganda and disinformation campaign against the organization by the United States and the mainstream media to discredit what Julian's doing. So for the last decade, I was deeply engaged in journalistic work. What I did was, interestingly, even though I knew Coin in 2013 or even earlier, I didn't quite realize until 2017 or later, I guess, what it really does. and how we could actually end this moral battle that I was engaged in. And that this, you know, so to speak, this fight of battle between good versus evil, you know, and take back the land of Narnia or take back United States from this tyrannical occupation, you know, by the US government itself, or that, you know, what is the force that is symbolized by White Witch, this oppressive forces that keep the world under winter all the time. And in 2017, for some reason, I once again kind of brought back to reading Chronicle of Narnia. And this time I read the last one, you know, the last battle that I didn't read as a child. And what's interesting about this book, The Last Battle, is that when you hear the title, Last Battle, you know, you kind of expect a bloody war, right? Like the people fighting and, you know, this kind of a dramatic battle or fight, you know? And that climax of it, like maybe the good will win. But, you know, there wasn't any battles in that book. It was not a battle. The way the battle ended, or, you know, way that this moral struggle or whatever, you know, or that occupation of a White Witch has ended, was simply this lion, Aslan, bringing out this stable door, the magical stable door. And then he let all creatures go through the door. So then anybody who is ready to walk through the door, just they could go through. And then they escape from witches' schools, and that they are transported into this new land of freedom. That's it. And I was so shocked because I was expecting that there would be some battles and some people were going to die and, you know, this bloody hell. None of that. It was a peaceful exit. And then, so for me, it's like, that's it, you know, that's the magic door that we all have to just walk through. And then I realized that's what Bitcoin does. Bitcoin is magic internet of money. And in the film Matrix, the Morpheus says, I can only show you the door. You have to walk through it, right? And then I find myself saying the same thing to other people, you know, when I try to talk about Bitcoin. I can only show you Bitcoin, but you have to take orange pill, basically. I cannot walk through the door for you. You know, you have to walk through the door. So for me, it was, yeah, it kind of, when I found out about it, obviously I had this kind of, I was stunned, you know, it's like, wow, you know, that's it, that's simple. And then all I have to do is, I just have to walk through the door. And then that gave me a sense of peace all of a sudden. Before I found out about this, obviously I was deeply involved in this effort for social justice. And I was, you know, I felt like I was on the front line of this battle, engaging in this, basically the war against the First Amendment, the United States government going after WikiLeaks and attacking, you know, the organization and Julian Assange. And then that war on the First Amendment still continues on. But then when I was on the front line fighting, this Bitcoin came along and that I was able to find the exit. Interestingly, I felt like history that is happening, that's now ended. It's kind of like the ego death, you know, because myself, that my role, character, personality that I so much identify myself with, this person, she has died, you know, and in the middle of this, engaging in this war on the First Amendment, she has died, that I could not get back to that anymore. It's like, okay, so now everything is over. And I found internal peace, profound peace, and Bitcoin transformed me. So yeah, long story short. So basically, Bitcoin is the imagination from computer science. It unleashes the power of, you know, magical power, creative power that allow us to, I think, become the author of our own history in our own life. And that we, having that, you know, each person claiming that creative power, we can change history. So in the sense that I think I discovered the potent force in history that moves, you know, moves and shakes history. And yeah, I think give us experience of what it means to be human in a full sense. So that power is in this piece of mathematics, I guess, you know, in Bitcoin protocol. And when I found it, it was just mind-blowing, as you can imagine.
Wow.
Yeah.
Zomi, I must say, I mean, thank you so much for sharing all of this. It's actually a quite common occurrence, but on this podcast, I find myself having these incredibly profound conversations where you're like, oh my God, I never thought about it like that before. And someone else has, and it helps to just the conviction in what Bitcoin is just grows when you end up thinking about all of these different angles. It's unbelievable.
It is unbelievable.
What this thing actually is. I now remember the story of Narnia. Perhaps I did read it as a child, but isn't that interesting? So the story ends with a door. And just have to go through it. And that
exactly
is incredibly similar to what we see as Bitcoin today. And it strikes me as interesting that you finished that story talking about human nature and what it means to be human. And that's obviously a question that you've been asking through your psychology studies, you know, through your journalism work. Like, what does it mean to be human? And so to chime on that then, you've been on this amazing journey that you've explained to us. And so Bitcoin has become part of your life. How has it changed you? And what does that mean in connection to everyone else that may not have yet gone through the door?
Yeah. As someone who was trying to understand human nature and studied philosophy and psychology, I must say that before I found Bitcoin, has been very distorted. I had idealized view of humanity, you know, it's almost kind of eliminated the shadow or dark side of humanity. You know, I had so much hope for human beings that humans are kind and altruistic and they are compassionate and they are loving, you know, and then we have maybe people who don't have empathy or don't have ability to be compassionate. There are people like that in the sector of humanity that is kind of psychopathic or manipulative and cunning and aggressive. And even though I knew that these people exist, somehow I was like thinking, oh, that's just the minority. And most of us are empathic and, you know, most of us are good. And I had really like, I had so much hope for human beings and idealistic views. And then in a sense that what Bitcoin did was Bitcoin corrected that distorted vision in a profound way that I have to look at the shadow. I have to look at this dark side of humanity that exists in not just in psychopaths or some small populations, but it's in all of us, you know, and we all have the darker side of ourselves and, you know, being greedy or manipulative or, you know, all the stuff that are kind of represented by psychopaths, the people who are identified as psychopathic. But that shadow side, that only became dark because of our unwillingness to look at it within ourselves and integrate them as part of ourselves. So because Bitcoin at its core embraces all that is human, it doesn't discriminate, you know, it doesn't have this moral judgment saying this is good, this is bad. It just simply, it neutralizes, it's just accept everything. And it doesn't create the separation between good and evil, which is the characteristic of Western Judeo-Christian morality. You know, Bitcoin's more like the close to the Native Americans' sense of morality, that it's kind of accept all the forces, even the force that is considered to be evil. Recognize that evil is part of good. And it's all life forces that you cannot separate. Yeah, so for me, what it did was that I have to look at the parts that I shun away step by step. I have to look at it and then I have to incorporate it back to myself without judgment. And then saying it only become evil or only become dark forces if I negate them, if I somehow deny these aspects within myself. And when I deny them, those aspects of myself will be basically detached from me and it has like its own autonomous forces in some ways. And then they could be projected out to the world, to certain people or situations, and that I have to deal with it. I have to see them from the outside, you know? You know what I mean? Like, I think Jung said something about, the psychologist Carl Jung said something about what we don't recognize, we would see it as fate. It's something like we would see it outside as kind of fate. That's kind of what he said something about that. And I very much agree with it. It's just a whatever we see outside as evil or bad or whatever, you know, that's just the what's in us, you know, that the things that we fail to recognize as a part of ourselves are just being projected outside, that we have to just interact with them in that way. So yeah, so that very much changed, I think, the way I look at human beings, and that now I have more realistic view of men, that human beings, you know, human beings are nasty, human beings are greedy, human beings are selfish, and they are pain in the ass, you know, but at the same time, we have capacity to be kind. We have potential to be altruistic, and human beings are kind. Human beings are compassionate, and they can collaborate as much as they can be competitive. So I see this contradiction living in nature. If you look at nature, we see this brutal forces, obviously, like, you know, lion eating rabbit and the brutality, or, you know, or the destruction, or, but at the same time, you see collaboration happening in nature. You see this kindness. So I think that to recognize this paradox and contradiction, and that we all, you know, human beings have this, yeah, paradox within us, and that only through us accepting our selfishness, our greedy nature, you know, our, yeah, tendency to cheat and manipulate and take advantage of others' goodwill, only through our honest acknowledgement of our nature that we can account for ourselves. We can take responsibility for our actions, and then we can strive to become altruistic. We can strive to be kind to one another, and we can, you know, strive to become species capable of love. And there is no way to bypass that, you know, no way to just ignore our shadow side or dark side to get to the light. You know, we have to embrace, we have to confront our darkness. And then out of that honest, I think, honest account, I think, you know, so that's why I like the fact that, you know, Bitcoin is accounting, you know, but not just like accounting in terms of finance, but it's accounting our action, you know, honest account of ourselves. And then Satoshi brilliantly found a way to do that, you know, because he had an honest view of human beings. He wasn't disillusioned, you know, like I did, you know, he didn't have this rose glasses on to look at human beings. He was realistic. He was like scientist, you know, who was able to see, yeah, you know, human beings has this part, you know, this dark side. And human beings also, yeah, I agree, you know, maybe have this good side. And so he was able to have this fullness, accurate view of humanity. And yeah, that honesty, that truth, you know, I think that helped. I mean, I think Satoshi to come up with this effective way to account to ourselves, you know.
I mean, there's so much there, isn't there? Wow. And again, like these topics, they don't necessarily seem related initially, but right. As you kind of pull them together, it's quite incredible, right. The different touch points of how one's life might change and how would that change at scale as well. It's quite incredible when you think about it. And it strikes me that, you know, when I think through business propositions, you have a very good problem statement, and the problem statement, if well defined, leads you to a good solution. But you get the problem statement wrong, and then the solution could be completely wrong. So your trajectory is already incorrect, and you ratchet that up at scale, and you get huge, huge course issues. And so if you're not honest with yourself and honest with how you feel and how you think and how you have tendencies for evil and for good, then the solution you're going to come up with is going to be incorrect in some ways.
Yes.
It's obviously highlighted just on a financial perspective by the fact that, you know, the base interest rate of the world is set by a handful of people in a room, you know, every quarter or whatever the hell it is, and how like disconnected from nature that actually is. Like, how on earth can they set the rate of risk for every single transaction? That doesn't make any sense at all. And so to come back to something you mentioned at the start, which was around revolutionary impulse. So how do you think Bitcoin kind of connects into that revolutionary impulse that you discussed before?
Yeah, I mean, I say it's revolutionary and evolutionary. So, you know, two things. But I think the origin of money, as Nick Szabo kind of described in his essay, and he was quoting evolutionary psychologist Richard Dawkins. And, you know, Richard Dawkins, he first coined the term reciprocal altruism, and that he describes money as a tool for reciprocal altruism. So if we didn't have money, basically, right, then like animals, for instance, what they do is that they engage in violent behaviors, perhaps. Let's say like if we didn't have money as a tool, and then if there's a conflict, then the way to solve conflict could be we depend on might. We would just fight each other and the stronger could win. But the introduction of money, the same as laws, the human beings find a way to solve conflict and problems without resorting to violence, you know? So that's, I think, for us as a species, it's a huge evolutionary leap that sets us apart from other mammals. That we human beings can build a society, build a civilization based on the principle of peace, so that we can maybe move away from the use of force and use of control and violence. Like money is fundamental for that. You know, without it, I think it's hard. We could be just like acting like mammals. We would just depend on might, whoever has weapons or whoever has, you know, strong muscles or whatever, you know, they could basically take over the society. So from that perspective, I think the money for Nick Szabo to recognize, I think, the origin of money rooted in this evolutionary impulse that guided our species to build the civilization and to evolve, I think, as a species and become human, you know, take a step toward becoming human. I find it to be very insightful. And so reading that essay helped me to see money in a completely new way, you know? And then that's the case with many people, you know, many people who first found the Bitcoin, the first thing they do is that not necessarily to understand the Bitcoin, but they would learn how the fiat system works. They will learn what money is, right? So that's the part of, you know, kind of a learning process that I also got engaged in when I found the Bitcoin. That, you know, prior to that, I had no idea what money is. Like, I didn't quite understand how financial system works and everything. So when I first found out about Bitcoin, then obviously, you know, I started to recognize how the fiat system works as an instrument of control. And it had so much cut off from the evolutionary impulse, you know, instead of money being a tool for cooperation. And I mean, it's used as a way to basically, you know, devolve us into back to this barbarian, you know, the animal-like existence. Because those who invent fiat money and those who control the money printing machine, they're using money as a weapon, you know, financial weapon to oppress us, to control us, right? They are taking it as a way to destabilize us, basically. You know, when we want to civilize ourselves and we want to evolve, they are trying to bring us back to this, you know, primitive stage, in my opinion. So Bitcoin certainly, yeah, disabled that and reversed the process, you know.
And it's funny how, you know, in day-to-day conversation, I still get so much pushback from people as like, Bitcoin's not real, it's going to get banned.
Oh, gosh,
The kind of conversation we're having now, it just makes complete mockery of that. And two stories that spring to mind. Shout out to El Sultan Bitcoin, who was originally from Venezuela, who came on my podcast, and he tells the story of living in Venezuela and experiencing hyperinflation. And also Bemba, who told me this amazing story of the history of the CFA and how the French have controlled the money in Togo for generations. And these are families that have their wealth just wiped out overnight because the people in charge feel like it. And the phrase financial repression is cancelled almost. Financial repression, you can't say that. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, well, hang on, it happens. And to say that Bitcoin is used as a, to say that money is used as a weapon, you're completely correct. Mm-hmm. What I'd like to dive into a little more is this concept of violence and that money is a derivative that allows us to not engage in violent activity.
Right.
And we spoke about free speech earlier. And in some ways, you can look at free speech as a tool for the same thing, right? If you don't allow someone to say what they feel and what they think, then they might just get angry and hit someone or hurt someone. How do you think money and freedom of speech are connected in that sense on the kind of scale of violence? Is that something you've ever thought through before? Because it strikes me they're kind of similar.
I mean, I think that ultimately, for me, I think the ability to speak freely and the freedom of expression that is supposedly guaranteed under the U.S. First Amendment, which obviously we know that is not the case. But freedom of expression is fundamental for us human beings, because what it does is that it allows us to become an author of our own life. Right. So if you look at it, then we basically are historical beings. We are in the story, collective story. And what we do is that we use speech, we use freedom of expression as a way to direct our actions, to collaborate with, associate with one another. And then we are forming story and narratives. And then through that narratives that we collaboratively create, we move our history and we create life, you know. And then, of course, you know, as a part of freedom of expression and then the way that we would take active role in shaping a history is our ability to move finance, to use resources in a coordinated way through the market, right? That's a very fundamental part, you know. And so money as a tool, you know, I think that it's a vital tool for us to express ourselves. And so if you look at ourselves, like in on the stage, creating the story or being a part of a history, and the question is, who is directing this story? Who is defining the story? Who is shaping the narrative? You know, and what's happening is that I think in the fiat system, we became, basically we are directed, you know, we don't direct our actions. We are, you know, caricatures of the prey, and that we are being directed from the forces, you know, the directors outside. They don't have it in our best interest, you know, they have their own agendas, and then they cast their roles. And then we were just praying, you know, that we don't have even ability to write our own story. So that's what's happening right now in the fiat system. So I think that from that perspective, what WikiLeaks did, you know, WikiLeaks fundamentally distributed the right to free speech so that the documents that are, were released by the organization empowered the people around the world, you know, people in Tunisia. That's where the revolution started, and that created a spark for revolution really was the disclosure of documents, you know, that Tunisians were in power, that they were able to see how their government were involved in corruption when they, before they didn't know. And so that information really empowered ordinary people. And that basically the waves of revolution or Arab Spring, so to speak, you know, it really created the global wide revolution. It moved to riot, Dignado movement in Spain, and then all the way to the birth of Occupy movement in the US, in the New York City. So the people informed by WikiLeaks publications, and that was the flow of information that was facilitated by the organization, empowered us, right? But we have seen that information itself wasn't good enough, that we needed to have free flow of currency as a form of information that allow us to coordinate, you know, use money as a collaborative tool to coordinate our actions, to create our own narratives and start to take back history. So I think that Bitcoin did that. You know, I think the Bitcoin really gave us tool to, yeah, continue on the momentum that WikiLeaks has created, that to further empower ourselves and truly become the author of our own life and author of our own history. So from that point of view, I think, yes, Bitcoin, money and freedom of speech are deeply intertwined. And once we take back money as a fundamental tool for us to, yeah, become an author of our own history, which is happening with the Bitcoin, I think we now, as a species, we can now evolve, you know, that there is nothing that is stopping us from evolving. And I think, you know, those who control monetary supply, central banks, and yeah, those who are close to the printing machine, what they are doing is that, they are doing Darwinian survival of the fittest. they are taking over the force of natural selection. It's nature that decides, you know, nature within us that decide who is going to survive and who is going to die. You know, it's not the bunch of people on the top in the hierarchical pyramid that decide and that dictate, okay, these people should die. The people in Venezuela, you know, they should die. And the way they do it is that they would hyperinflate their economy, and that those innocent families that they cannot live, so that they have to die. They are the one who deciding, right? Acting as God, acting as nature, and then selecting, you know, whose life is worthy and who is not, you know? And nature doesn't do that, you know, obviously. Nature act as a neutral arbitrator, I mean, in a sense that it's help everyone who is willing to help themselves, I think. And the Bitcoin, you know, allow us to do that. You know, whoever find Bitcoin, you know, he or she would start to help him or herself to live. And so, yeah, so I think the Bitcoin help us end this artificially created natural selection by the few, and allow nature to do the work, you know? Yeah. And that brings social justice, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's very closely connected to social justice, isn't it? Wow. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to see how this kind of maze of ideas kind of all pulls together in terms of these different threads Yes. that you've been interested in your lifetime. It strikes me as interesting as well. The system that is the status quo financial system that's centralized, and that there is a select mm-hmm. few that control what happens and where, mm-hmm. funnily enough, too big to fail exists in their system.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
This
whole
idea of lender of last resort. Oh my God, we've got to kind of like save our best buddies, right? Nature does not do that.
Nature
is the ultimate free market. It will, you know, you either live or you die. Very
and then nowadays, you know,
sense.
you probably know that this financial market, I mean, the derivatives and then all of that, they are betting on human misery. You know, they are deciding, you know, like saying, okay, there will be this disaster, and they are betting on it. They are making profit by prediction, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, that if you look at it, that it's like these people who are involved in finance in that way, I mean, are they looking at us as fellow human beings, you know, or are they looking at us as object, bunch of animals that, you know, I don't know. I think that's kind of sometimes make me wonder, you know.
I think that people are sufficiently removed from the actual impacts of their behavior to live a comfortable life in whichever kind of a suburb that they live, and they're able to disassociate themselves with the genuine impact. That would be my instinct on that.
Yes.
And well, Nozomi, we probably have time for one last question. And I have to say, everything you've talked through today, it gives me such confidence that, you know, this thing that is Bitcoin is, you know, not just an incredibly exciting time in terms of a renaissance of a sense.
Yes.
And who knows what flourishing we'll see as a result, but also just in terms of your own personal financial decisions. You know, okay, this is actually clearly this is the area I'm more interested in than the traditional system. I'm happy to move my wealth into Bitcoin. And even making that decision is a hard process for a lot of people. You have to trust this new thing. You got to learn all about it. But some of the conversation you've had today, it's very simple to understand. You know, how people feel, how people think. We talk about this all day, you know. Oh, how's my child today? Are they good or are they bad? You know, how's my mom feeling? These are very kind of simple family conversations that happen. And money is, of course, connected to it. But my final question is going to be more of a, I don't want it to be negative, but what are the biggest threats to Bitcoin, in your opinion?
Biggest threat. Okay. I think that Bitcoin itself, I mean, it's a protocol, and that has shown to be immutable over 14 years of existence. And I think the closest that, I mean, what I was starting to worry about the integrity of the protocol around 2017, when the scaling battle started, the, you know, so-called block size debate, and that turned into the, you know, very dramatic. And that so at that time, like, I was really worried. Like, I was just thinking that maybe there is a way to take over, compromise the protocol. But after seeing the outcome of the block size today, you know, basically Bitcoin is fine. Nobody could have control over the protocol. and its development. So that gave me a tremendous confidence that after going through this, I was able to see, okay, this is really decentralized, and it's the Bitcoin itself at the protocol level, it's fine, you know. But I think the threat could be the political. Bitcoin itself is fine, but I think the media or the politicians or the state actors, they could always demonize Bitcoiners. They could go after Bitcoiners, you know, they could outlaw mining or, you know, certain companies to exist. These kind of efforts to compromise Bitcoin at the kind of legal level, that I think we have seen that. Was it last year or? Yeah, I think it was last year that in the US that there were a certain kind of proposal to pass the legislation to, you know, kind of outlaw the self-custody, for instance. That's, I think, could be the threat, I think. And, you know, I think the people in the fiat system, they're obviously, I mean, those who benefit from the fiat system, they see Bitcoin as a threat. So they wanted to somehow, they wanted to suppress this technology. And, but they can only use their tools, you know, which are legal tools, right? Laws, or media, you know? So these are the two things that they could use. And they could either, yeah, like just demonize or paint the bad picture of Bitcoin, demonize Bitcoiners, you know, engage in the negative PR, you know, that's all they could do. But so that's why I think Bitcoiners, we are, you know, important part of defense. You know, we are part of, you know, the protocol. I see Bitcoiners are like the second layer of the protocol that, yeah. Yeah. We also have to, you know, that when the threat comes at the judicial level or the media, through the media, that's when we have to engage, I think, to defend the protocol. We have to engage in educating public about Bitcoin accurately. And there are a lot of false narratives, obviously, being created every day, you know, like how the mining, Bitcoin mining is boiling the earth or... Right. So we have to be, and right now I think that what I found is that this FTX, the collapse of FTX exchange, and that is used somehow to paint the picture that the Bitcoin is
bad.
Yeah, Bitcoin's bad. And people ask me, like, you know, are you okay with this? Bitcoin is kind of like, you know, this guy, you know, who went to jail, he's engaged in criminal activities, and is Bitcoin, it's like I have to tell them, like, this has nothing to do with Bitcoin, right? And so these are the things I think that the Bitcoiners can help people be informed about, you know, what's happening, I think. So,
and it's precisely why I wanted to start this podcast, actually, and have conversations like this, where there's a very grassroots community of people growing, and we talk to each other. You can share these conversations. People then learn from them. And I mean, quick shout out to the Wizard of Oz, if he's listening. There's an organization here in Australia called the Bitcoin Bush Bash, which he set up with a couple of friends. And he calls Bitcoin as the Bitcoin social layer. And kind of very viral and organic community of people that are all kind of like a moth being drawn into the light.
And
this is seen all over the world. That's what's so amazing. It's totally decentralized community. So you're in Australia or whichever part of the world you might be in, there are people who are joining this protocol. Why is that? And that's really what this podcast is all about, actually, is asking that question. Well, Nozomi, thank you so much for your time today. It's been absolutely awesome to hear your story. And do you have any final comments you'd like to make? And equally, where can people reach out if they want to get in touch?
Yeah, thank you for having me. I mean, I really enjoyed our conversation. And yeah, I agree that it's the education is the key, and the Bitcoiners around the world, you know, who care about, who understand the revolutionary aspect of this technology, and that who are, you know, who love to inform people about this technology, and that we really are, I think, vital part of the social, like you said, social layer of the protocol, you know? And so, yeah, so I very much appreciate your efforts, you know, creating this content. I mean, this is a really important effort. So I'm glad that you invited me to be a part of it. So the best way to follow my work is on Twitter, at Nozomi Magin. So that's my Twitter handle. And I also have a sub-site for the Way of the Heart. You can subscribe the site. And I write for Bitcoin Magazine, so you can also find my newest articles there.
Awesome. Well, Nozomi, thank you so much for joining today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, friends, nice work. You made it all the way to the end of the episode. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this conversation. As I said at the start, if you have any questions, then please don't hesitate to reach out. And if you enjoyed the episode, then please rate, like, subscribe, and share. That's it for now. Enjoy the rest of your day. All the best, Jake.